Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, June 16, 2016. Catholic bishops in South Sudan say President Kiir and former rebel leader Riek Machar must work together for peace.
We are also concerned on the day-to-day lives of the people, especially the insecurity that is still there, the fear that is there within the people, and the worries, and also some of the difficulties they have in regard to their way of living.
And residents of Abyei relocate to Sudan because of lack of services.
The situation is so bad, Yeah, you see, people are going back to north because there is a lack of food, also there is insecurity, there is no any settlement, any kind of settlement here.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The International Organization for Migration and Residents of Abyei say the number of people fleeing hunger from the disputed region and other parts of South Sudan near the border with Sudan has increased over the past month. Some Abyei residents say people are moving to Sudan in search of better living conditions, including medical care. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from WOW.
Abyei resident Achai Anel Kwol says with constantly rising prices of food and other basic commodities, many people are left with nothing to eat. Anel says her family eats only one meal per day. Speaking in Arabic, she says unless the situation improves soon, she too will have to leave the area.
Citizens in Abyei here are suffering. As I speak to you now, if we eat today, in the morning, we will not be able to eat again in the evening. When you take 2 meals per day, it means the next day you have to go hungry. So we are economizing what we have so we can have a meal per day. I think by July or August, there will be no people staying in Abyei. Many have fled the area because there is no food.
Resident Biar Manur says there is no motivation for people to stay in Abyei.
The situation is so bad, Yeah, you see, people are going back to north because there is a lack of food, also there is insecurity, there is no any settlement, any kind of settlement here. That's why people are rushing to north.
Manut says despite the challenges, he will not leave Abyei. He says he already planted crops, including sorghum, and hopes to have sufficient food to feed his family after the harvest season in about 2 months' time. Achol Deng, another Abyei resident, says she too has planted crops and is waiting for the harvest. Speaking in Arabic, Deng says if she ever does decide to head to Sudan, it will be in search of better services.
I think what is forcing people to go to Sudan is that we are facing a problem of lack of medical care, which is a big issue. There are some diseases that cannot be treated here in Abyei. That is why people here decide to go to seek health care services in Sudan.
IOM officials say at least 52,000 people have crossed the border to Sudan since the beginning of 2016. Carl Becker is IOM's Transition and Recovery Program Manager in South Sudan. He says majority of those fleeing Abyei are heading to Sudan's East Darfur state. Becker says an estimated 1,000 families have left Abyei in the past months alone.
It's quite true that people are moving through, but for different reasons, from education to health care to even visiting family, as was done in the past. But there's no real reports of a mass migration of people from Abyei moving into Sudan. There are those from northern Bahr Ghazal who have been moving into Sudan and the southern part of Sudan, like South Darfur. Those are different than the ones who come through Abyei.
Becker also attributes the increased movement to relative peace in Abyei.
We've also seen good progress on the ground between the Masirian and the Dinka, having good discussions and making sure that they are living in a peaceful way. I think there's a very grassroots level movement going on where people want to come back together and want a peaceful Abyei.
On top of that, Becker says political discussions in Khartoum seem to be moving in the right direction over the past 3 weeks between Masriya Arab nomads and the Ngok Dinka on how to coexist peacefully. Late last year, the Security Council extended the mandate of the United Nations peacekeeping operation for the disputed Abyei area until May 2016. Residents of the disputed region have been without administrative structures since 2011, after South Sudan separated from Sudan. Since then, South Sudan claimed Abyei as part of its territory. The Sudan government attacked the area in May 2011, prompting the UN Security Council to deploy a peacekeeping mission to the area. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
Mungume Devs Rakarinj contributed to that report from Juba. South Sudanese Catholic bishops are calling on President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar to publicly assure citizens that they are working together to restore peace and stability across the country. The bishops just concluded a 3-day workshop reflecting on the political situation in South Sudan. Nabil Biagio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Catholic bishops, priests and nuns from the 8 dioceses across South Sudan wrapped up their 3-day workshop in the capital today. The bishop of Tumbura Yambio Diocese, Edward Hiboro Kusala, says the bishops shared information on South Sudan's political and security situation and talked about the way forward. Bishop Kusala says the people of South Sudan deserve to know that their bishops are praying and working for peace as the nation goes through economic crisis and political instability.
We have been able to inform ourselves what has been taking place in different parts of South Sudan, in our own dioceses, and we have come up with a statement. And the statement is a statement of courage, of hope. And we are calling our people to be courageous, not to be afraid.
Kusala says the bishops also discussed South Sudan's faltering economy and how people are coping with the stress of skyrocketing prices and other economic hardships.
We are also concerned on the day-to-day lives of the people, especially the insecurity that is still there, the fear that is there within the people, and the worries, and also some of the difficulties they have in regard to their way of living. All these things concern us. You know, as a church, we are part and parcel of the community. We know what they go through.
Charles Abuti, Secretary General and spokesman of the Catholic Bishops of South Sudan, says the bishops are sending a message of peace and hope to the people of South Sudan.
The people of God, especially the people in the Republic of South Sudan, should work for peace. Not to criticize others, but let us work for peace and genuine peace.
The bishop's written statement criticized the actions of some members of South Sudan's military, saying, quote, "The current Sudan People's Liberation Army is not the same army which protected and liberated us between 1983 and 2005. We are deeply concerned that many of these armed men appear to be poorly disciplined, poorly trained, poorly led, poorly educated militia, preying on the population rather than a disciplined force protecting the people." End quote. The bishops are calling for the formation of a single professional national army, one that the South Sudanese people can be proud of. And Kusala says the government must protect its people, saying security is a responsibility of the army, the National Security Service, and all sectors of government. The bishops are also calling on President Salva Kiir and First Vice President Riek Machar to honor the agreement they signed and to publicly reassure the citizens of their willingness to work together for the good of the nation by making both practical and symbolic gestures. The bishops invited the two leaders to make a brief spiritual retreat together, one which the bishops offered to facilitate. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
And in Uganda, the church has no kind words for the government. The Catholic bishops in Uganda say the country's judiciary is increasingly allowing itself to be used by the government in its dispute with the opposition. The bishops under the Uganda Episcopal Conference also warn Ugandan security agencies against clamping down on the legitimate political activities of the opposition. This comes after former opposition presidential candidate Kizza Besigye wrote to the country's chief justice warning that the independence of the judiciary was gradually being questioned. Monsignor Matthew Odong is the vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu, northern Uganda. He tells VOA's James Batty that the bishops want the judiciary to be impartial.
The bishops are concerned about those people who are arrested, and reasons sometimes are not very clear, and sometimes they are taken off to the court. And judiciary being one of the three arms of the government, I think what the bishops are concerned is that their judgment should be just and should not be influenced by the government in any way. They should be guided by the law of the land, by the constitution.
This comes at a time that the court has rejected the government's plea that Dr. Besigye, who has been arrested and charged with treason, should be tried in Kampala and not at Luzira. Do you think this is an improvement?
It's not clear to me whether Dr. Besigye is to be tried in Luzira or in Kampala. You know, I think the concern of the bishops still comes back to the same thing. Is he guilty? The judiciary handling the arrest objectively or due to the influence from the government? So about whether it is Luzira or Kampala, you know, to me, it still just comes back to what the bishops of Uganda are trying to put forward to the government of Uganda and also to the whole world, that the arrest must be genuine and somebody must be proven guilty and also given a moment, you know, to defend himself or herself.
This is a direct attack on the judiciary.
Well, I thought the bishops are very clear to the judiciary to be autonomous and to be guided by the legal principles of justice, of truth, other than, you know, allowing their judgment to be influenced by the government or externally. I think that's what the bishops are.
What if the government says that the bishops are trying to interfere in political matters?
Well, the government could say that, but the bishops are also citizens of the country and they are to be protected by the same constitution and by virtue of their offices, their positions as religious leaders, they also have a right to speak on behalf of those who are arrested and the judiciary look influenced by external force. So the bishops, they've got the right to speak openly that, no, look here. You know, you, the judiciary, you've got to stand on the basic principle of law and let your judgment not be influenced by the government. The church is the voice. The church is the conscience of the society, the voice of the oppressed. And in a situation of injustice, the church cannot keep silent because it will betray its vocation.
That's Monsignor Matthew Odong, vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu. He was speaking to VOA's James Batty from Gulu, northern Uganda, earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN mission in South Sudan hands over a fish market to traders. Stay tuned.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
were you born at a hospital or at home?
I was born at home by my aunt, who is a midwife. She helped deliver me.
Yes, I was born in the hospital. I was born in Mengo Hospital. Maybe I may call it luck. By then, my parents could afford that. Yes, so I got the chance of getting born in hospital.
Hospital. My mother is a nurse, so probably she knows she's supposed to have safe delivery.
I was born at home in Al Ghadarif. Yes, I asked, but that time the labor pain started at night and the hospital was not near to us. So what she did, they just called the nearest midwife then she delivered at home.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Residents and local leaders in Bor are welcoming the opening of a new fish market in the area. They say the market will ensure proper hygiene and will boost the fish sales. The United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, which constructed the market, handed it over to local authorities this week. Jacob Achek has the story for VOA from Bor.
Hundreds of women sang traditional song to express their joy as UNMISS officials turned over control of the new fish market to local leaders near the Nile River. The women, a majority of whom have been selling fish on the bar floor, say the new market will make their work easier. 40-year-old Achola Yuen has been selling fish in Bor since 2008. Speaking in her native Dinka, she says more people will be encouraged to buy fish here now because of the clean environment.
Some of the people were not interested in buying a fish from us because they saw us selling it on the background. But after the opening of this market, we are seeing people coming to buy from us. This market will make our work easier because we are not seated under the hot sun. We are under a shade. That means our fish will not go bad.
38-year-old Ayan Ding has also been selling fish here for the past 5 years. Speaking in Dinka, Deng says she was tired of sitting in hot sun in a windy area.
And if there is a fish to be sold, we will sell it inside the market while sitting under the shade. Unlike in the past, we won't face the hot sun anymore. And we won't have to sell the fish the background where there is a sun. We will sell clean fish.
Ayan Mayama Ajag lived in a camp for internal displaced persons before returning to Bor in 2007. Speaking in Dinka, she says she learned how to fend for herself living in the camp.
Life in the bush and in the IDP camps taught us how to research for our own food. And when I came back to Bor in 2007, I had nothing to eat. So I went to the riverside to sell fish. Whenever I earn 5,000 Sudanese pounds in a profit, I put it back into a business. And if I earn a profit of 10,000 Sudanese pounds, I would give 5 of it to my children. I thank those who built this market.
James Jock Allier, Deputy Director of South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Jonglei State, says the fish markets will help address hygiene problems and prevent the spread of diseases. Jock says state officials asked UNMISS to fund the construction of the project in order to support women who want to earn a living.
The reason why we are very happy, they have saved our women group from sun, from rains, and from an hygienic environment. Today they will be able to sell their fish in a conducive place where they will not be under threat of sun, they will not be under threat of rain, they will not be under threat of bad hygienic environment.
Deborah Shingwin is UNMISS field officer in Bor. She says the market is not only a place to buy food, but a place where people can socialize.
The purpose of this market is it's a quick impact project that UNMISS has built, and the aim is to improve the sanitary conditions, the hygienic conditions of handling, storing, and selling fish.
Gwyn says the market will also promote peace among the different ethnic communities in Bor. A local organization called Humanitarian Development Consortium built the markets for about $5,000. The market is spent in and divided into several shelves designed to be used by up to 40 fish sellers, all of whom are women. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
The corruption case against ex-Malawi President Bakili Muluzi may be heard for another postponement after dragging on for 9 years. Muluzi and his personal secretary are accused of stealing aid money and misappropriating public funds. Lamek Masina has the story for VOA from Blantyre.
Bakili Muluzi was president of Malawi from 1994 to 2004. During that period, he and his former personal secretary, Linus Whiskey, was accused of stealing 1.7 billion Malawi kwacha, which at the time was equivalent to about 12 million United States dollars. The funds were originally aid money from the Republic of Taiwan, the Kingdom of Morocco, and Libya. The lead prosecutor recused himself a month ago. The trial was to resume Monday, but now may be facing another postponement. The new prosecutor said a key witness is not available and asked the judge for 30 days to review the charges. Tamando Chokoto is the lead defense counsel. He says he also needs more time to prepare.
You should appreciate this is quite a bulky matter. It involves a lot of documents, a lot of evidence. And if the case is changing in any way, we'll need quite some time to prepare fully.
The trial opened in 2009 and has been subjected to several adjournments, partly because of Muluzi's hospitalization over his spinal problems. Both sides rejected allegations that they have been working to deliberately delay the proceedings. The 73-year-old former president has always said the corruption charges were politically motivated. Some see political interference in the delays. Muluzi is now part of the opposition UDF party. But the ruling DPP party recently joined forces with the UDF in parliament. Muluzi's son, who is president of the UDF, is now a cabinet minister. Political analyst Vincent Konrowe.
When the cases are not really given the impetus and momentum which they require, then you begin to question the political willingness that is there to prosecute people holding public offices who are accused of plundering public resources.
The state anti-corruption body says the repeated delays are not about politics, but Malawians are getting impatient. Local press reported this month that the state has spent as much as 12 million United States dollars on this case. The government did not respond to a request for comment on that figure. Eric Matola is a teacher in Blantyre.
The funds which are being used to prosecute this case are public funds, of which I contribute through tax. Therefore, I see that it's a wastage of resources on how the government is handling this matter.
Malawi has been under the microscope for its anti-corruption enforcement since 2013, when an audit revealed public officials had stolen $32 million in public funds. The Cashgate scandal, as it was called, led to about 70 arrests and prompted the European Union and other foreign donors to cut aid. Malawi lost about $150 million in annual assistance, but much of that aid remains suspended pending reform of Malawi's public finance system. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
South Africa is marking 40 years since the Soweto student uprising that marked a pivotal turn in the fight against apartheid. As the nation looks back on the tragic, violent protest, South Africans, young and old, say their nation is better for it, but still far from perfect. VOA's Anita Paul reports from Soweto.
The tragic events of June 16, 1976 were a major turning point in South Africa's fight against the apartheid system. President Jacob Zuma on Thursday recalled the horrors of that day, known then as the Soweto Uprising, and today celebrated as Youth Day.
Heavily armed police opened fire on the students as they were marching peacefully towards this stadium. Had refused to disperse.
On that day, some 20,000 high school students protested in the segregated township of Soweto to protest the apartheid government's insistence on teaching in the Afrikaans language. Police opened fire on the marching children. Estimates vary on how many children were killed. Some go as high as 700. One of the first victims was 13-year-old Hector Peterson, whose name today adorns a museum on the site of the massacre. Many of the surviving students are now grandparents. but the memory has never left them. Upa Moloto is today a project coordinator in a foundation centered at the museum. The 58-year-old was among the marchers that day and said he initially mistook the gunshots for firecrackers until he saw the boy next to him bleeding. He paused when asked, "Was it worth it?"
My kids got education from multiracial schools. To them, issues of color, issues of race, they are not entrenched like when I was growing, because when I was growing, issues of race were the key, they were determining. Yes, I do agree there's still a long way to go in terms of getting rid of apartheid. I mean, it has entrenched itself in economy.
One legacy of apartheid is that black students remain significantly poorer than their white peers. University students highlighted that argument when they launched protests last year demanding free education. That debate continues. Many who protested in 1976 say they have no regrets. Florence Kanye was an 18-year-old high schooler at the time and participated in student protests in the city of Bloemfontein. She says police gave her a lasting reminder of her activism.
Even now, I have a pain at my back that is from the effects of that time. Now, I have that pain that doesn't go away. Sometimes as that pain comes, it will go, you know, right down. It's from the beating. Because in those rooms that they were locked us in, before they took us where they were locking us up, they were beating us with something like a plank.
If anything, she says, the experience galvanized her. Today, she is the principal of a Catholic school in Johannesburg. She emphasized education with her own two children, she said, beaming as she told of her oldest, who is now a university student. It only seems fair on this historic day to give the last word to a young person. But since he is only 15, we first asked Vladek Nlovu's parents if it was okay for him to speak to us. Then we asked him, "What would you say to your parents and to your grandparents?"
Let us thank them for what they did for us, because we have freedom. We can do everything in this country.
He smiled shyly as he told us he wants to become a lawyer when he grows up. For Moloto, Kanye, and Zuma, that was an impossible ambition in a nation where black students could not go to top universities, could not live in or even visit white neighborhoods, could not vote, could not become president. 40 years later, for Ndlovu and his friends, nothing seems impossible. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Agamlong Agar by Akoi Jazz Band. We have been listening to Akoi Jazz Band with the song Agamlong Agar. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
nijenge bayo.